right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have a it's going to be a really interesting show today. I know this is one that you never hear. You never hear a show like this on the air anywhere at this point, and that's unfortunate, all right? We're going to be talking about the history, the reality of the communist revolution of socialist societies. You know, it's just, it's an incredible history. It's a history that has been kept from people, has been distorted people, and worse than being kept from people, it's been distorted and vilified, and basically people have been robbed of the possibility of dreaming and knowing that that dream isn't just a dream, but it's something that can be made real in the world. And we've been robbed of the opportunity to see what has been done and what the world could look like without this this life-robbing beast of capitalism, imperialism out there running things. And it's been done before, and it's possible to do not only do it again, but to do it better and to really take big steps towards something that people don't even have the ability to conceive of, a world that is based, that is full of emancipated humans, a world that's emancipatory, that's about the emancipation of humanity. And the question of how to get there is what this is all about. And I want to make a special announcement at the front end of the show today. We are taking calls at the back end of the show, but once again, I have to warn people that if you're listening to this show now, it's pre-recorded and you won't be able to call in. So someday, hopefully, we'll be able to hear from each and every one of you. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Pose your questions and we can figure out a way to actually make this work, all right? But right now, don't try to call in because you're only going to get frustrated and mad at me, and I don't want that to happen, all right? Joining us to talk about this today is Raymond Latta. Now, Raymond's an advocate for Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism, and he's a political economist. He's the author of American Decline and a writer for Revolution Newspaper. He also directs the Set the Record Straight Project, which brings out the truth of the Soviet and Chinese revolutions and provides web resources to everyone who goes there, and people should really go there at Set the Record Straight. Check that out. Look it up. Check it out. Go to it. Raymond Latta, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thank you very much for having me on today.
Sure. Well, you just authored, or you were just the subject of an interview that was carried out that was all about this, what I was talking about, the history of socialism and the communist revolution. And the interview is titled, "You Don't Know What You Think You Know About the Communist Revolution and the Real Path to Emancipation, Its History and Our Future." And I can tell people right away, so people can also go and check this out on the web. If you go to revcom.us, you'll be able to access this and read it, and you really should. This is really just a remarkable piece of work. So, Raymond, let me jump into it right away here. Why don't you tell people what the interview is, what it covers, and why you felt it was important to get this out now?
Yeah. Well, as you said, the title of the interview, it's very sharp and very deliberately worded. And you don't know what you think you know about the communist revolution and the real path to emancipation, its history, and our future. And what I'm talking about in this interview is the first stage of communist revolution. And I'm specifically referring to the great Soviet and Chinese revolutions, but prior to that, the Paris Commune of 1871. That was the first and short-lived attempt to create a new mode of governance where the formerly exploited and oppressed took responsibility, came to power, and tried, as they did in Paris in 1871 in March, you know, to create something new, to break the vice grip of exploitation. So when we're talking about this first stage of communist revolution, we're talking about the short-lived Paris Commune, and then we're talking about the Bolshevik or the Russian or the Soviet Revolution. Those terms are used interchangeably from 1917 to 1956, and the Chinese Revolution from 1949 to 1976. Those constitute the first wave or the first stage of communist revolution. And if we step back, we have to look at what they actually represent. And that is, these were the first attempts in modern history to create societies free from exploitation and oppression. The first attempts. And they were tremendously and overwhelmingly liberatory. These were new societies, new political structures, new institutions. This was about the former nobodies, the people who had been on the bottom of society in alliance with the broad majority of society, consciously setting out to create a society in which people are cooperating, working for the common good, and carrying out a process of social, economic, and cultural change in the context of contributing to the advance of revolution on a world scale. So this is, as I say in the interview, a leap out of the darkness of the past, the darkness of class society, a society divided into exploiters and exploited oppressed, and the oppressors who determine their lives and who monopolize the means of creating society, of reproducing society, the wealth of society. So these revolutions, as I said, were a breakthrough, something that really does represent a new dawn for humanity, a world in which we can move beyond classes, a world community of humanity. People want to know, what does communism mean? Well, communism is a world community of humanity, a society, a world society based on the principle of from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs, and where there are no more divisions among people in which some rule and oppress over others, in which people are being robbed, as you said at the outset, of a means to a decent life, and critically, the means to understand and change the world. So these revolutions were that first breakthrough, that first chapter, and their history and the experience and what people did in their tens and hundreds of millions, this history is suppressed and it's distorted. And what I'm emphasizing in this interview, Michael, and to the audience, is that anyone who cares about the state of the world, anyone who dreams of a world without exploitation, oppression, without privilege and domination by the few over the many, needs to learn about, needs to know about, and needs to really become immersed in what this actually represented, this breakthrough. And in doing this interview, I'm trying to bring that experience, these lessons to light, through the prism of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism, which enables us to really understand why these were tremendously emancipatory, something new for humanity, and at the same time, what their problems and shortcomings were, and how we can build on and go beyond and go further and do better in the future. So there's a lot riding on this, Michael, in terms of the truth of these revolutions and what this represents for human possibility. In other words, these revolutions are actually showing us that the world doesn't have to be the way it is, and that there's nothing that's built into, hardwired, or coded in human nature that says that we have to be clawing at each other, that we have to be just self-aggrandizing atoms colliding with each other, that we can actually create a society in which people are working for the common good. And people need to know that now in today's world because of the state of the world.
Mm-hmm. You know, Raymond, I got to, and let me remind listeners, we're talking with Raymond Latta. He's a political economist, author of American Decline, and director of the Set the Record Straight Project, as well as an advocate of Bob Avakian's new synthesis of communism. And we're talking about the history of revolution and communism in the world, and the first stage of that revolution. Raymond, one of the things as you're talking, this wasn't just a question. This is something that it's controversial. It flies in the face. What you're saying flies in the face of everything that's been said about these revolutions, about these societies, including all the way down to the beginning of it being presented as, look, these were revolutions. It wasn't just, it couldn't be done or whatever of just a small group of people who tried to impose their ideas on things, or that it was sort of, they sat around and said, well, we don't really have time to vote, but let's have a revolution. But nor was it just sort of like a matter of a handful of people deciding that this is what they were going to do. Why was revolution, and particularly, a revolution to actually take over state power, why was that necessary? And then we can talk about what difference it made.
It was necessary because the nature of the world as it is today is a world in which you have a small minority of people, the capitalist imperialists, who control not only the economic lifeblood of society and the world. In other words, these people have a stranglehold on the economic resources and on the world economy. These people not only control the lifeblood economically, they control the social and political institutions, and they control the means through which they enforce their rule. That is a state power. I'm talking about the military, the repressive organs, the courts, prisons, you know, all of those repressive institutions and the political structures, you know, that correspond to those institutions, you know, the legislatures, you know, in the parliaments, in the Western capitalist imperialist societies, and in Russia before the revolution of 1917, you know, there was a harsh rule of the Tsar. It was kind of a monarchy that then kind of fused with some parliamentary forms, you know, in the period of early 1917. These were oppressive structures that were holding people down into the status quo, that were preserving the dominant economic relations of capitalism and keeping people in this state of subordination and enslavement to the status quo, a status quo that serve the interest of the dominant and the privileged classes. So there was no way out. You know, there was no way out of the suffering of these societies. If you look at the Soviet, you know, the Russia before the revolution of 1917, China before the 1949 revolution. In Russia, the great majority of the population were the equivalent of shareholding peasants. And, you know, these were people that were subjected to the control of both the aristocracy that controlled vast amounts of land, the church. This was a society in which you had extreme, extreme oppression of minority nationalities. About 45% of the population was made up of minority nationalities, and yet they were not allowed to carry on education in their native tongues. You had pogroms that were carried out against the Jewish people. You had this extremely repressive mode of rule, this, you know, this autocracy that was associated with the Tsar. So you had this kind of vice grip on the institutions, on the wealth of society, and you had a class, a ruling class, that was maintaining its rule through force. And this was the situation that the revolutionaries were confronting in Russia and then in China. That is, if you are going to actually carry out a social revolution, if you are going to uproot all of this exploitation and oppression, then you go straight up against the power of those who hold the reins of control over society. And that's why I'm sort of speaking about the relevance to today, because people right now are stirring and rebelling. We're seeing protests and uprisings in Egypt, in Greece, in Brazil, and Turkey. And people are searching out solutions and philosophies. And all kinds of programs and outlooks have gained traction and a great deal of following. Leaderless movements, anti-hierarchy, anti-statism, horizontalism. Many of the listeners will be familiar with this, anarchism. But those programs and outlooks don't to the essential point that I'm emphasizing about what these revolutions addressed, which was, if you are going to actually change the fabric of society, if you're going to create a new kind of economy, new political and social structures based on meeting the needs of people and overcoming social division, then you need to go up against and defeat the state power of the oppressor classes and to create a new state power that both enables people, empowers people to carry forward these changes, and also can suppress counter-revolution, those from within society, the old exploiting and new exploiting classes, and imperialism and foreign powers that will seek to destroy and choke this new revolutionary society. So this is very essential. It's the starting point. You need a new state power to empower people, take out, to carry forward change, to suppress those who would stand in the way of that and try to preserve and, excuse me, to bring back the old order, to protect the rights of people in carrying forward this kind of change. So that was very, very essential. That was a key lesson that Marx and Lenin drew from that short-lived Paris Commune that I described. That was this moment in March of 1871 where people rose up in Paris and they went about creating new political and social institutions in terms of separating church from state, of dealing with issues affecting women, of creating new forms of accountability for leadership. But they didn't deal with the problem of who held state power. The military, the French bourgeoisie, still had its military strength. It regrouped and crushed that upsurge. So these are critical lessons that have been paid for in blood. So this is the first step, to mobilize the masses of people to build a movement for revolution, and this is what the Bolsheviks, the communists led by Lenin, did in Russia in the pre-17 period and going forward. They mobilized people to both overthrow the old structures of rule, but then that was only the beginning. It was on the basis of overthrowing the old order and creating a new state power that it became possible, and this is what happened in Russia, it became possible to create new institutions that were actually serving the advancement of revolution, the transformation of society, empowering people to change the world and change themselves with leadership. And vanguard leadership is so crucial in this whole experience.
All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Raymond Lott, a political economist and writer for Revolution Newspaper and the director of Set the Record Straight Project. Raymond, you walked right into this, and it's important to get into it. What? Give people a sense of how did life actually change after, as a result of these revolutions? What was actually opened up in the society? Concretely, what did it look like in the Soviet Union after the revolution?
Well, first of all, let me just say, after the revolution is an ambiguous term, Michael. It was there is no after the revolution, so to speak. It's after the revolutionary seizure of power, because then the revolution actually begins in earnest. In other words, overthrowing the rule of the old exploiters and oppressors and then moving forward on the basis of that. And this is an important lesson in terms of the experience of this first wave of socialist revolution, of communist revolution, something that Mao, really, enabled us to understand much more deeply about how the revolution has to continue. So I just want to say that, because I think there's a lot of confusion about after the revolution in terms of that's the end. You overthrow the old order, and then you just kind of set about constructing a new economy, new social institutions, and things take care of themselves. But that's not the case. You have to continue to revolutionize society and people's thinking, and people have to become increasingly conscious and capable of understanding and changing the world in the interest of the emancipation of world humanity. So in the case of Russia, after the seizure of power, you have immediately the promulgation of two stunning decrees. One was the Bolshevik leadership. This is the revolutionary leadership, the Bolshevik Party, the party that would become the Communist Party and, changing its name. But this was the Bolshevik Party that led that revolution, the vanguard of the revolution. It issued two stunning decrees. The first, it took Russia out of World War One, and World War One was this monstrous, mechanized, modern war. Some 20 million people died in that war. This was a war that was a war fought by the exploiting classes, by the imperialists, to divide up the world and to bring more misery to more sections of the planet. Well, the first act of the revolution in power was to remove Russia from that war, to put an end to that slaughter and to call for an end to that war. And second, it carried out a vast land reform. It distributed land from the Tsarist crown, from the old aristocratic landholding classes, and from the church. So these are the two first decrees of the revolution that already indicated that something new and something radical was about to happen. And this was only the beginning. And one thing I want to emphasize that people know very little about is that this revolution carried out extraordinary innovations in the realm of women's liberation and in the realm of overcoming the treatment of minority nationalities. I mean, this was the most earth-shaking, the most radical transformation of gender relations that had been carried out up until then. I mean, immediately the revolution abolished, this whole procedure, this whole practice of the church, the Russian Orthodox Church having to sanction marriage, and the codification of male authority over women and children. This was immediately challenged and immediately overturned. Divorce was made easy to obtain. Maternity hospital care was provided to women. The Soviet Union became the first country in Europe to legalize abortion. And this was a tremendous advance in terms of, you know, the ability of women to take part in all spheres of society. And, you know, you compare that to what was happening in other parts of the world. I mean, it's just night and day. Even in the United States, you know, you had, you know, people fighting for the right to vote, women fighting for the right to vote, who were sort of subjected to all kinds of repression, harassment, even force feeding in prison. And then, you know, you talk about a sea change in social relations. One of the most exciting and dynamic things that happened in the 1920s in the Soviet Union was the struggle against, you know, patriarchal customs in some of the Central Asian republics. As I said, the Soviet Union, you know, prior to the revolution, was a society in which you saw many minority nationalities in Central Asia and other parts of what became the Soviet Union, subjected to all kinds of horrific national oppression and the oppression of women. Well, a big focus of the revolution in power was to challenge all the patriarchal and oppressive customs, Islamic Sharia law, that were holding women down. And it gave backing. And here's another illustration of your question, Michael, about the importance of state power, that now women had the backing of the government, of the state. Funds were allocated, resources, organizers came into these areas from the cities, and then there was local organization that was being built up, and major campaigns were launched, you know, to challenge and to turn back and to put an end to the backward customs of bridal price, arranged marriage, and very importantly, a campaign was launched. A major offensive was launched in 1927. Put an end to the centuries-long practice of the forced veiling of women. And we know, the listeners to your show know what the forced veiling of women, I hope they do, represent. It is an oppressive signifier, then and today, of patriarchal control of the faces, bodies, and humanity of women. And this was the object of mass struggle, in which women were being given backing and men were being encouraged to join them. And this is what was going on in the 1920s in the Soviet Union. And then in the cities and in society more generally, you know, in the newspapers, in the schools, there was lively debate about sex roles, marriage, the family. You know, I like to tell people that, you know, science fiction novels were a very popular genre in the Soviet Union. And these novels were envisioning new family relations, new family structures, moving beyond the nuclear family, new gender roles. So the whole question of patriarchy was being examined, interrogated, and this is what was going on in the Soviet Union in the 1920s. And again, I emphasize, people need to know about this, people need to learn about this, and this was a breakthrough. There were weaknesses, there were problems, there's a deeper understanding now of the centrality of emancipating women as part of a crucial and central part of the struggle to achieve communism. But this was an incredible breakthrough. So the kinds of things that I'm describing are things that people really need to know about and learn about.
All right. Let me tell you, Raymond, I want to encourage people to go to revcom.us and check out the entire interview, because we're going to be, you know, we have a limited amount of time and we can't really cover everything as in-depth as it is in this interview. And it's really important for people to check this out. I think it's something that everyone needs to read, study, and spread around. Now, Raymond, one of the things, and a listener just wrote into Facebook with this question. I think it's important before we get into China, because I want to get into China, but there's a sort of question here that's sitting. Great, all the things that you're talking about, really tremendous, but at what cost? And the question that was raised as, you know, are purges seen as a necessary element of all this actually taking place and developing? You know, and that's a big question that comes up in relation to the Soviet Union and in different ways with China as well. So can you speak to that, and then we'll get into China later?
Well, I mean, the question of at what cost is an important one. You know, we're talking about the relationship between the means and the goal. And the goal is to create a society and world free from all exploitation and oppression. You know, Marx described the communist revolution as a revolution of two the two most radical ruptures with traditional property relations and with traditional ideas. And that's what was happening in embryo in the Soviet Union, and even more deeply in the in China during the Chinese Revolution, and especially through the Cultural Revolution. But I do want to emphasize that the changes that took place were really breathtaking. And I've mentioned around women and the question of minority nationalities as well. And I just want to, so that your audience, your listening audience knows that, you know, in the case of the Soviet Union, you know, in 1917, all minority nationalities were granted the right to instruction in native languages. Many minority nationalities that had no written languages were supplied with alphabets. There was incredible diversity in terms of translation, in terms of people being exposed to different cultures. There was the challenged Great Russian Chauvinism, which is like white supremacy, white privilege. In this society, people were being educated about the true history of these oppressed nations. As I said, resources were made available for the teaching. New leadership was being brought forward from within these former oppressed regions, and they had regional autonomy, the ability to carry out policies and take responsibility for governance, you know, that reflected the particularities of their development. This is all incredible, not just in relation to what the Soviet Union was like before the revolution, a prison house of nations, but incredible in relation to the world we live in today, where in the U.S., for instance, it's English only, you know, and here in the Soviet Union, you know, you had this attempt society-wide to put an end to the inequality between nations and nationalities in terms of language, in terms of culture, in terms of the resources. So I just want to emphasize that, so we really know what we're talking about. Now, in terms of what cost? Well, here, I think we have to understand that, one, the revolution is fighting for its life. It's facing imperialist encirclement. No sooner, you know, did the revolution come to power in 1917 than a few months later you have an intervention by 14 foreign powers in alliance with counter-revolutionary forces in the Soviet Union, you know, who were seeking to overthrow the new rule. One year after the seizure of power, November 1918, three-quarters of the Soviet Union is in foreign hands, is in enemy hands, is in the hands of counter-revolutionary forces. So when the listener calls in about at what cost, there's a real contradiction here, which is, how do you defend the revolution against assault and onslaught, both from counter-revolution from within and revolution from without? How do you mobilize the masses of people to actually take up the big questions of moving society forward, of overcoming inequality and social division? How do you educate and raise the consciousness and understanding of people so they recognize more deeply what the goals of that revolution are and how to carry that revolution forward consistent with those goals, in terms of raising consciousness, in terms of enabling people to more consciously understand where we have to go, where humanity has to go. But these revolutions are not made in velvet boxes. They're not made in vacuums. This is my point about counter-revolution. So the question of at what price is a question that is really a central question of this first stage of revolution. These revolutions were overwhelmingly carried out and led with a vision and with an understanding of bringing this new world into being. And they overwhelmingly relied on the conscious activism of the masses of people. But in the case of the Soviet Union, you have some serious problems in how Stalin, in particular, was dealing with this question of how to defend the revolution from assault, that is, from counter-revolution. How to actually stand up to the imperialist powers, and how, at the same time, to defend this revolution, its achievements, and to go forward. And Stalin made serious mistakes in terms of how this was understood in terms of the problem of counter-revolution, and how it was actually addressed in terms of dealing with that problem. And in the case of the Soviet Union in the 1930s, especially in the late 1930s, as the danger of invasion. The German military, German imperialism, was the most modern military in the world and was preparing for a war of annihilation against the Soviet Union. And here we have a response on the part of the leadership, you know, that actually cut against the goals of the revolution. That is, the measures and the means that were taken to defend the revolution were more or less measures to hunker down, to create a kind of fortress of socialism. And there was a wave of repression that was directed against both genuine counter-revolution, but also whose net extended far beyond people who were actually engaged in counter-revolutionary activity, people that were engaged in dissent, who were disagreeing with policies, who were making mistakes. And it was in this context that you see some of these problems and some of the excesses and some of the very grievous errors that were made in the 1930s, the purges and so on and so forth. And this is something that I address very deeply in the interview. You know, what was it that gave rise to this response? What was it that Stalin understood about the nature of socialist society? There were real problems in understanding in terms of the danger of counter-revolution, where it came from. And there was a view on Stalin's part that any disagreement and opposition to the socialist policies and the defense of socialism was coming from a place that was A, counter-revolutionary, or B, you know, in the service of international intrigue and counter-revolution against that revolution, against the Soviet Union. So there were serious problems, and these are things that I address. What price, the listener is asking, or the Facebook writer is asking, that's a crucial question. And what I'm saying here is that there's been a learning curve.
All right, on that note, Raymond, the learning curve, we're going to have to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have about 10 minutes to get into that learning curve question. And particularly, I want to hear about China because it directly follows from that. But we're going to have to, if we're going to have take callers in for about 20 minutes, we're going to have to come back real quick and get into that and then open the lines up, all right? So we'll take a quick break and be right back. Welcome back. That's Chairman Mao, Ed Blackwell with Don Cherry and Charlie Hayden. And joining us to talk about the history, the truth about the communist revolution, about socialist societies is Raymond Lada. Raymond is the director of the Set the Record Straight Project. He's a writer for Revolution, the author of American Decline, and a political economist, as well as an advocate of Bob Avakian's New Synthesis of Communism. Raymond, before the break, you were talking about the learning curve. And I want to take a jump from that to let's talk about China. What was, similar to what we were talking about in the Soviet Union, what difference did the revolution make? But also, what about that learning curve in terms of what was unleashed in China? And probably one of the biggest things that people really don't know anything true about is the Cultural Revolution. So can we talk about that?
Yes, I think it's very critical that we do, because there is this learning curve. It's one of the themes that I emphasize in the interview, that there was this first breakthrough in the Soviet Union. There was no blueprint. There was no previous model. There was no precedent for what the Soviet Union was facing. That was the threat of war, this constant encirclement. And there were the mistakes that were made by the leadership, by Stalin, in preparing for war, in dealing with this problem of counter-revolution. And Mao had made the observation that Stalin failed to distinguish between two types of contradictions. Contradictions between the people and the enemy, those are antagonistic, and contradictions among the people. This was my point earlier about differences and disagreements and dissent, and these got conflated. Again, this was coming from a very dire situation in which there was an existential threat to the revolution. And how that was understood and how that was acted upon is, again, something that's addressed in great length in the interview and in supplemental material people can go to the thisiscommunism.org site to learn more about. Now, in the case of China, Mao is summing up, you know, the lessons of the Soviet Revolution, where the, you know, breakthroughs were made, where there were problems, and how to go further and do better. This is what Mao is trying to deal with, the problem of how to keep the revolution revolutionary and how to actually deal with the problem of the emergence of new privileged bourgeois forces. Now, I'm jumping ahead, and let's just go back to 1949 in China. What you have there is the next great revolution of the first wave, first stage of communist revolution. This was a revolution that was born, you know, amidst incredible misery and suffering, you know, on the part of the Chinese people. You know, in China was a society that by the mid-19th century, listeners might have heard about the Opium Wars, you know, was divided up, which was launched by Britain, which was a dominant power in China. China was carved up, you know, by different imperial powers. Its economy was extremely underdeveloped. You know, it was a society in which feudal warlords kind of threw their weight around. It was a society in which the vast majority of people, you know, the great, great bulk of society was made up of peasants who suffered from, you know, incredible landlord despotism. You were enthralled, were enslaved to the landlords, had to hand over a good chunk of their crop, went into debt to be able to live, who in bad years, in famine years, in years in which their yield, their crops were falling short, you know, were suffering intensely, having to sell daughters to pay debts, having to eat bark in periods of famine. I even mentioned in the interview that, you know, that dying of famine, dying of hunger, just part of life's destiny and course in pre-revolutionary China, as though no different dying of disability, dying of old age, well, you might die of famine. This was a society where women were subjected in the countryside to oppressive, horrible, horrible conditions. You know, the practice of foot binding, where women's feet were wrapped, their toes broken, because this would keep their feet small, and this was considered aesthetic and erotic in patriarchal society. And in World War II, here too, as in the case of Russia, before the revolution came to power, you know, now you have a situation of World War II where China is engulfed in this great inter-imperialist conflict to divide the world among the exploiting classes. And China was subjected to this Japanese invasion. And it was just brutal, brutal in terms of what it meant. In Nanking, the city of Nanking, Nanjing, it's pronounced today, in that city, 300,000 people were murdered, raped, you know, massacred, you know, under the, you know, the occupation of the Japanese imperialists. And China came out of that war, World War II. You know, the Chinese communists led the masses of people to throw off the Japanese. They waged a civil war against the U.S.-backed Kuomintang government, and they set to work on creating a new society. And immediately, there too, change was dramatic and decisive on the basis of establishing a new state power, which was a form of the dictatorship of the proletariat, an alliance of the proletariat with the peasantry. And right away, land reform was carried out. This was an incredible land reform. This was not just land being given to peasants, but this was peasants being empowered by the new state power to stand up to the old landlords, to break out of the old ways of organizing production, to break with superstition, to challenge, you know, the old ways of thinking. And that land reform resulted in the distribution of some 30 to 40% of the arable land in China. And it was the most massive redistribution of wealth, the most massive distribution of land, the most massive repudiation of debt in world history. And on the basis of that, peasants were able to stand up, were able to join together in cooperatives, were able to move from that to communes. And we can talk about that later and perhaps in the Q&A. And for women, right away, the transformation was dramatic. A new marriage law was enacted, which put an end to child marriage, to arranged marriage, that granted women the right to divorce. The whole practice of foot binding that I described was put an end to. And you now have a situation in which a society was being organized around the principle of women hold up half the sky. Because as Mao emphasized, it wasn't just a matter of law and edict and formal equality for women. You had to challenge the oppression of women in the deepest, most thoroughgoing ways, in terms of attitudes, in terms of ethos, in terms of patriarchal authority, in terms of women being locked into the family and into the clan, the small groupings of people by bloodline and by community that kept women in a very insular and provincial state of life. These things were challenged immediately. And this was an incredible breakthrough that took place. And right away, mass campaigns were launched to put an end to epidemic disease. 4 million people died of infectious diseases a year in China before the revolution. That was put an end to. Hospitals and medical clinics were constructed. Huge campaigns to raise literacy. These were the things that were happening in the early stages, in the first 10 years. In the first 8 years of the revolution. And you see these great, great economic and social changes that take place. But Mao was going further. Mao was saying, we need to carry this revolution to a whole new level, to a whole new place, in which people are not just obtaining social or economic justice, as we would use the phrases today, but in which you're really beginning to transform the whole social fabric, the whole value, the mindset of society in which people are working for the common good and in which the former nobodies, as I said, are taking increasing responsibility for running society and for transforming how they relate to each other. So these are the things that are going on in the first few years of the revolution, but then now, with the Great Leap Forward, takes this to a whole new place, and it goes to a whole other level in the Cultural Revolution, where Mao is putting forward and giving orientation to a whole way in which it's possible to prevent the emergence of a new privileged elite from seizing power within the structures of socialist society, and in which you open society up in a whole other way to interrogation and to transformation, in which, as Mao did during the Cultural Revolution, called on people to rise up against the new oppressive structures that had emerged, the new power centers that had emerged within socialist society that were dragging society back towards capitalism. And this was totally different than what happened in the Soviet Union, where, as I said earlier, Stalin was dealing with the question of counter-revolution through administrative measures, through purges, through attempts to save the revolution, which didn't really raise the consciousness of the masses of people and which didn't transform institutions of society. But the Cultural Revolution was Mao's attempt, and it was an incredible breakthrough, to deal with this problem that the questioner raised earlier. That is, at what price? How do you actually defend the revolution and carry the revolution forward in a way that is consistent with the goals of unleashing the conscious activism of people? And the Cultural Revolution was unprecedented. Never has there been an episode in human history where people set out to transform the institutions and the thinking of society ever more consciously through experimentation and raising the consciousness and changing the ethos of people. And this is through their involvement in great mass political struggles, in political and ideological debate. This is what was going on during the Cultural Revolution. And the whole face of society changed in education, in culture, in how factories were organized, in the very concept of what a factory was. It wasn't just a unit of production. It was a place of political and cultural struggle. These are things that we can talk about more, the role of the Red Guards, the youth being unleashed to actually wake people up to the fact that socialism in China was becoming stagnant, And this was something that Mao was addressing, but in a way that, as opposed to what happened in the Soviet Union, hunkered down and closed things up. Here, it was being opened up and being challenged and being interrogated in this incredible way through big character posters and these great debates and through the youth going to the countryside, through people in factories awakening to political life on a whole new way.
All right, Raymond, and I want to let people know that we're talking with Raymond Latta, and we're talking about an interview he had in, and it's published in a Revolution newspaper, and you can go to revcom.us to see it. Raymond's a political economist, the director of Set the Record Straight Project, and he's a writer for Revolution newspaper. And the interview and the theme of this show right today is You Don't Know What You Think You Know About the Communist Revolution and the Real Path to Emancipation, Its History and Our Future. And I want to make a special announcement. Once again, I have to warn people that if you're listening to this show now, it's pre-recorded, and you won't be able to call in. So someday, hopefully, we'll be able to hear from each and every one of you. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslade@redfuture.com. Pose your questions, and we can figure out a way to actually make this work, all right? But right now, don't try to call in because you're only going to get frustrated and mad at me, and I don't want that to happen, all right? Now, we only have about maybe 10 minutes or so for questions, so I'd really like people to call. If you have a question, let's try and keep them brief and succinct and you know, to the point. Give us a call. Put your question out there, and Raymond is looking to dig into it all. Let's go to line one, Marvin. Marvin from Sherman Oaks. How you doing, Marvin?
My question is, I'm against capitalism. I think it's horrible. The history of capitalism it has been a disaster. We all know that. But now communism, you know, communism is about victory, no? I mean, it seems to me that communism has military intentions. In other words, they want to win this war. They have the atomic bomb. They got all these weapons, don't they? And the movement that we have going on now is nonviolence. That's the movement we have. So can you answer and you talk about nonviolent people in communism?
All right, Marvin, thank you very much for your question. Raymond?
Michael, I didn't hear that fully, so I'm wondering if you could just briefly characterize.
He was basically saying that he's against capitalism. He's against capitalism. He likes to think about the victory of communism. On the other hand, he's worried about the question of violence, and is there a nonviolent way of, or is not nonviolence involved at all in communism?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're living in a world in which, you know, violence is the rule of life for imperialism. I mean, this is the violence of the wars that they have prosecuted. I mean, U.S. imperialism, you know, after World War II, 3 million dead in Korea because of the U.S. invasion and the U.S. support and the U.S., the U.S. orchestration of the Korean War. 3 million more dead in Vietnam. In Indonesia, a coup takes place in 1965 with U.S. CIA backing, 500,000 people murdered. Every day in the world, every day, 18,000 children die of preventable disease and malnutrition. This is the violence of this social order. This is the violence of everyday life and imperialism. And here in the belly of the beast, you know, the scourge, the epidemic of police brutality, of police murders. I mean, this is what this system ultimately rests on, you know, it ultimately rests on the enforcement of its rule through, you know, force, through military force, and through the maintenance of rule by means of repressive organs of control, the police, the military, the prisons. So this is the way this system is set up, and it is all in the service of preserving capitalism, which you're listener is saying he's opposed to, and that is a system of organizing society and the whole social order around profit and the exploitation of the vast, vast bulk of humanity in order to extract profit, to rip off and control resources. So this is the problem. Their control over the state power, their monopoly, not only over the control of the economic resources of society, but their monopoly on the legitimate use of force, their control of military power. So there can be no genuine, substantive, thoroughgoing change unless and until that fact is changed. That is, unless and until they are no longer in power, they are defeated, their repressive military structures are defeated in a revolutionary crisis, you know, through the mass mobilization of millions and tens of millions of people in revolutionary struggle. And this is one thing that stands out about the Bolshevik and the Chinese revolutions. These were uprisings that were led by vanguard parties that were able to solve the problem of how to defeat the superior military might of these ruling classes by mobilizing the creativity and the determination of those who had suffered along with the great majority of society. These revolutions were able to go up against that might. But there's no way in which you can enact the kinds of social transformation that I'm talking about unless and until you defeat and dismantle the state power of these forces. And that's a lesson that we're seeing in Egypt. That's part of the reason for this interview right now, its urgency, because in Egypt and in other places where people are rising up, you know, people are motivated by tremendous yearning for justice, for putting an end to the suffering in these societies, the inequalities, you know, the treatment of women, all of these kinds of questions that we've been addressing. But the state power is still intact, the Egyptian military, you know, and people cannot sashay around the fact that you cannot change the fundamental workings of society unless you change those power relations. And on that basis, and with a scientific understanding of how the world is and how it can be changed, how to restructure an economy, how to create a socialist economy that serves the needs of people, how to create new social institutions that really enable people to stand up and to remake society and to change their thinking. But the essential point that I'm emphasizing is that you cannot do that without defeating the state power of those who rule over the lives of humanity.
All right, Raymond, we have about time left for one more question. We have about maybe four more minutes left. So why don't we go to Jesse on line four, and he has a question about the importance of preserving individual autonomy and how does that fit in with what you're talking about. Jesse, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Exactly. I'm completely on with the redistribution of wealth and not having an oppressive centralized click or running everything. I just want to know about saving individual autonomy. And there was a time in the old days when nobody went to school to get an MBA or business something. It was liberal arts, and you could study all kinds of things. And then you had enough space and time in your life for hobbies or whatever you want to call them. And you didn't want to become a wage slave working at some just one job. So how do you manage to save the freedom of the individual?
All right, Raymond. And we have about 3 minutes right?
Yeah, I think it's very important. Jesse, thanks for the question. What the new synthesis of communism that has been brought forward by Bob Avakian is addressing lots of different aspects of how to create a society and world in which human beings can truly flourish and learning from and building on, but going beyond the experience of this first wave. In other words, how can we go further and do better? And one of the areas in which we have to go further and do better is in this realm of how do you create a society, an economy, political and social structures in which people are cooperating and working for the common good, and at the same time, they're developing their individuality. And you want to have a society that both prioritizes social need. We have to address the oppression of women, racism, the environment. We have to deal and confront those questions. And that does require leadership. It requires centralized structures in terms of economic planning, in terms of being able to solve the environmental question. But at the same time, how within a framework of
30 seconds, Raymond.
Ownership, yeah, how can we at the same time, you know, develop people's individuality. And this framework, within a cooperative collective framework, you want to have the fullest development of people's individuality, people going off in different directions, exploring, learning new things. You don't want to have a situation where, in the name of social priority, you're suffocating individuality. You need to be developing that in the context of society that's moving towards communism, towards overcoming the division of society into classes. And this is why people should go to the website, revcom.us, and look at Avakian's writings on these and other questions and the interview.
All right, Raymond, thank you very much. All right, we've just been talking with Raymond Latta. And if you want to check this out, check out the entire interview. You can access that interview at revcom.us. That's revcom.us, all right? And you can also go to the site thisiscommunism.org. And you can access all of that through revcom.us. So you can get there a million different ways, but however you choose to get there, because you have never, never come up against something like this. A wall of truth standing up against a barrage of lies and falsehoods that actually has real meaning in the world today in terms of whether or not we're able to actually get rid of the horror that we live under today, all right, and what kind of world we're going to build in the future. All right, well, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Nellish Lalani and Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Nadia Richardson. And I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And you can follow me on Twitter and Facebook, but again, very carefully, very, very quietly, and don't scare me, okay? And if you will, like me on Facebook, because once again, we are on a huge, massive campaign to change the world. And apparently, I'm thinking that if we get enough of those likes to give me those special superpowers, can't hurt. It can only help our quest to change the world, all right? So like us on Facebook as well. All right, we're going to go out now with Communist Moon, and it's from International Noise Conspiracy, and it's one of my favorite songs. It's a very beautiful, very powerful song about a whole new world, so check it out.